Small, medium enterprises, in particular mid-sized companies, create 70% of all of the jobs in the U.S. and in developing nations. So if you really want to create jobs, then you have to get somebody that can actually be running a medium-sized business and grow it and scale it to create the jobs that will lift people out of poverty.
Welcome to the Social Impact Solutions Podcast, where we help mission-driven leaders measure and market their social impact so they can raise more money and do more good. I'm Lauren.
And I'm John Mark. Together we bring you expert insights, practical strategies, and real-world stories to help you create more meaningful and measurable change. This podcast is designed for purpose-driven leaders. So let's dive in, explore what's possible, and take your mission to the next level. Welcome back to the Social Impact Solutions Podcast, where we help nonprofits and mission-driven organizations measure and market their social impact so they can raise more money and do more good. I'm Jean-Marc Vanderpool, and today I'm excited to introduce you to David Sims. David is someone who's not only led at the highest levels of business and nonprofit, but has also dedicated his life to creating scalable, sustainable, and transformational impact around the world. David is currently the managing partner and founder of Talentin, an impact investing firm dedicated to deploying capital to create jobs and transform communities. And to date, Talentin has helped create over 800,000 new jobs in East Africa alone. I'm really excited for us to get to dive into this conversation about thinking big, taking bold risks, and building a better future for those living in poverty. You're in for a real treat today. Let's go ahead and dive in. David Sims, thank you so much for being here today.
I am just delighted to join you, and thanks for this opportunity.
I've been looking forward to this for a long time. So I think I talked to you first about launching a podcast. I think it's been about a year and a half ago, if I remember correctly. And you're like, hey, you should totally do it. And then obviously plenty of time went by and, you know, finally took your advice. So thank you for the nudge that was needed.
Well, it's neat to see this happening, and your audience will just be blessed, I'm sure, by your wisdom and the people that you'll bring, myself excluded, to their awareness.
Well, that's very kind of you, but I'm going to have to push back a little bit on the self-deprecation right there. So you have a fascinating story arc, right? A fascinating career. You do wonderful work with Talentin that I want to camp out on a lot in a few moments. But I think it's important for people to understand, how does one go from everything that you're doing in corporate consulting, everything that you're doing as a White House fellow, everything that you're doing before then, that then eventually led to impact investing? Like, can we just start, you know, go back in time a few years, a couple of years, and then see like where everything came together? Because I've got a few questions for you about what you learned along the way.
Well, one of the secrets is if you give the Lord enough time, measured in decades, eventually he gets you right where he wants you to do exactly what he wants done. So I can look back over decades of experience to say, okay, I was wired for business. I went to Wharton undergrad, and I did a JD MBA at Harvard. So I had the academic training and rigors. I started at Bain & Company. A guy by the name of Mitt Romney hired me. So many people have heard that name and got me started. And what do you do with a orientation for impact, which quite frankly, the old 80-20 rule was what we had to master at Bain & Company in order to deliver value for clients. Mm-hmm. But along the journey, despite a corporate career that continued from there, the Lord got a hold of me first to find Jesus. That was critically important in my life. And then to let me follow Jesus in how do you serve the least of these in the developing world? That's really a calling you put on my heart. And becoming involved in the developing world to bring business and faith together in a microfinance way. And use the skills that I learned as a consultant and then as a business leader, as CEO of several different businesses, as another consultant for 8 years as a partner at Bridgespan. I really learned an awful lot along that journey, which is what he's used to allow me to build Talentin, as we'll talk about in a bit.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. So obviously, well-educated. You obviously had your motor was working pretty well early on in life, which is great.
My wallet was being emptied is what you mean to say.
Yeah. So. I think I could still hear that noise of all the money being pulled out at the same time, which is, well, yeah, you got your return on that. But it's fascinating though, going straight from, you know, that situation, JD MBA, obviously Wharton undergrad, everything that you did there, but going straight into, you know, one of the best, you know, consultancies that's ever existed, right? With what you've done with Bain. What would you say that early in your career? What were sort of the pattern identification that you were going through of like, huh, that's interesting. This is working very well. And what has stuck with you since then? Just from that time at Bain, there are many other examples too.
Yeah, I guess what I had the joy of starting to do at a Bain that floated my boat is I had a chance to do an awful lot of new business development work. So even though I was working for Fortune 500 companies, I was working on new startups quite regularly inside of a business or a turnaround, mm-hmm. which people may say that's nothing like a startup. And I'd say, no, there's an awful lot of startup when you have to go push the reset button and take a underperforming business or seriously at risk business and figure out how do you actually go around turning around the culture mm-hmm. And seeing the opportunity to create impact. Right. And so I've always enjoyed doing things that had this really needs to be changed. And then I have the orientation to be a change maker and to go see how could the world be made different and better. And that started at Bain. And then I had a chance to be CEO of a Red Cross division that was a big turnaround. And it was just the same theme, but in a different setting.
Right.
To do things that hadn't been done before or weren't working well.
Right.
Getting things running well is just, it brings joy to me to be able to help people in that way.
That's what I was doing. Obviously, I've known you for several years now, a couple of years at this point. And we've had wonderful conversations, had a chance to work together. But I didn't take away, like I did in just doing research in preparation for this podcast, that you were a turnaround guy for many years. Like that was literally what you did. Like, oh, wow, underperforming. Great companies, great organizations. Not saying anything negative or pejorative about the organization, but these were big turnarounds that you were helping orchestrate.
It was a big turnaround, or it was a big thing that had never been done. If I look at the things that I'm proudest of in my career, being part of the board of a group called Opportunity International Microfinance Organization, when my wife and I first became involved decades ago, that was 1,000 clients, a couple of million and a half, maybe in total revenues, a couple of countries. And by the time I was asked to step in as the executive chairman of the board, decades later, I'd been instrumental in helping them along that journey get to 12 million clients. We put out 1.2 billion in loans, operated in 42 countries. Now, that was a team. I was not the leadership that did that, but I was the board chair, the head of fundraising, led people all over the world. So it was an opportunity to create something that was desperately needed. How do you help people living in deep poverty in a microfinance way that hadn't been successful before? And the amount of innovations to go from 1,000 clients to 12 million, would take the rest of your podcast to just say, this is what had to happen in order to do that. And that was the joy of doing that in a lending savings business. And then launching a micro insurance business that nobody thought was possible. And yet we found a way to take a business that was bringing life insurance in sub-Saharan Africa, HIV and rampant in the countries in which we were launching, had no exclusions for anything. And we were providing life insurance, 20 cents of revenue per month per person.
Wow.
And I have yet to find anybody else that's willing to say, I would like to bet in that business model that you're going to launch a life insurance business that grew during my sort of tenure as the chairman of that to 60 million lives being insured across multiple countries across three different continents. I like seeing the Lord do stuff that we can't do, but he can, and they need to be done. That's kind of fun.
What would you say, if you were just humor me, spoil me a little bit on this, what were some of those massive undertakings, just for that last example, the life insurance example, what were some of those ceilings that, hey, we've got to solve these three problems if we're going to break through that ceiling? We've got to solve these three problems if we're going to break through the next one, just to humor us a little bit.
Well, how do you do something that's never been done before is one ceiling, right? You're doing life insurance. And the reason why life insurance sell to rich people like most of those of us in the U.S. is because they have money. And the reason they don't sell life insurance to people that are at the base of the pyramid is because they don't have money. So how do you create an economic engine that is actually going to serve people and do it in a viable way? Come on, this can't be done, right?
Right.
Well, it can if you can use, back in those days, we're using nonprofit catalytic capital to just incubate and innovate. Mm-hmm. And then you say, okay, how do I make the cost structure 20 cents of revenue? How do you possibly do this? Well, you put it into a cell phone technology, which was all over Africa, and you make it the loyalty program to create stickiness to the cell phone carrier that made it embedded in their products as a way to get life insurance distributed on their nickel, not ours. It generated value. So the value chain of partnerships was a huge, finding. Mm-hmm. It's those kind of things that you had to solve. But even back in the earliest days, how do you fund this thing? Who's going to do this? And fortunately, back in those days, the Gates Foundation had somebody that wanted to do something big and was willing to give us an enormous check that mm-hmm. never should have been written in order to go figure it out. And here's some money for you guys to go figure it out. Those were enormous challenges, but you just work through them one at a time and see what happens.
That's fantastic. I think the takeaway for a lot of people hearing that is not the somebody wrote a big check. I think that's the mm-hmm. that's important. But the takeaway is relentless innovation, right?
Yes.
Think on your toes again and again. Solve the right problem at the right time with the right people. Yep. Relentlessly.
Yeah, the big check didn't come first. The big check came because we had ideas and put together a small team against a huge problem and went to some people that said, we understand the problem and we think you guys with your team, and you're crazy enough to believe you could do this.
Mm-hmm.
So that the innovation, you can't be afraid to tackle something that's never been done before, or you can't tackle the world's biggest problems. They wouldn't still exist if they weren't big challenges. You need innovation to go tackle.
I love that, David. So a lot of people that listen to this are nonprofit leaders, and this was a nonprofit venture that you were running all the time.
Yep.
And so I think it's really important to understand big problems with capable people does attract big capital, right? And so I think too often we sort of toe the line, or we sort of hold back because, oh, that might be too risky, or that might be too big of a bite for our team to take on, or funders would never get on board with something like that. How many times have you seen that not be the case?
I will frequently give advice that if you come to an investor, a donor investor, with a small problem, you're going to get a small check.
Right.
If you come with a small vision, you may not get any check at all. So I encourage people to think big. And I had a conversation yesterday with a guy that's starting a new ministry business as mission and wanted to figure out how to tackle reaching closed countries with the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going to self-fund it. I said, well, if you're going to self-fund it, it's going to be a small answer. Because if you don't design for letting other people join you in tackling the problem, you can't possibly create a global solution.
Right.
He wanted a global solution. He needed to get out of his own way and not have the pride of, I'm going to fund this, be the limiting factor on what could happen to make big stuff work.
I wonder, just you immediately diagnosed the constraint being, well, this is only going to go so far, right? Because you've worked with at-scale organizations and you helped small organizations grow to at-scale organizations. Understanding the math involved, like, listen, if we're going to reach this many people, it's going to cost at least this much, knowing that we're not going to be able to accomplish it otherwise.
Yep. And we'll get to Talenton wherever you want, but what led me to Talenton was there aren't enough charitable dollars to significantly make a dent on global poverty, certainly across Africa. 450 million people alive today that are 18 years old and under. You can't donate your way into creating enough jobs to lift people out of poverty. You need a different answer.
Right.
So that's sort of, it was that big problem in an inadequate solution.
Mm-hmm.
Say you've got to innovate to say, how do we tackle it in a different way? If we're going to succeed.
Right. You know, when you were with Opportunity International, you obviously saw a lot when it came to the microfinance, when it came to the insurance. With what you're doing with Impact Marketplace is also interesting. Would you mind just shining a little bit of light on that as well?
Yeah, when it was clear that we weren't able to tackle the moving people up out of poverty as much as I had hoped in the microfinance model, we originally said we would do something to try and bring capital to businesses that could, we'd find the businesses, then we'd raise the capital for them to invest. That model didn't work, but that was the innovation. But it didn't work because two things. You'd find the business, they immediately needed capital, and we hadn't yet raised it, so it was a disconnect. And then you needed to support the business afterwards, and we didn't have a capital, we didn't have a revenue system to support ourselves. So we tried that for 6 months, 9 months, maybe it was a year or longer, and said, okay, that doesn't work. What we really needed was to create a fund, a true SEC-registered fund, which we then named Talentin. That's Talentin is Greek for talents out of the parable of the talents. So some of your listeners and viewers will remember that the Lord instructed us, take 5 talents and invest them wisely to hear, well done, good and faithful servant, or take 1 talent and bury it in the ground. And I don't think I want to be the 1 talent buried in the ground, and I like serving people that want to take 5 and go here, well done, good and faithful servant. So the model said, let's go create a fund structure, pre-raise the capital, find the companies, invest wisely, and then support them exceptionally well. Mm-hmm. And if you can find the right kind of leadership team, back to it makes a difference who you're investing in. You invest in the right kind of leadership team, that's who creates the jobs. And jobs are the root cause for poverty. Lack of jobs is the root cause for poverty. So create jobs, you can go right after poverty at its root cause. And we can now do that with a fund structure that is what we put together at Talent.
Right. Which is, you know, like you said, it's the innovation. That was how you innovated. Like, okay, well, we're going to look at this differently. And if I remember correctly, please correct me if I'm wrong, you started off with a DAF, like sort of a nonprofit model. You were accepting, accepting DAF capital. Yep. Obviously, you raised money from private investors as well. But again, just saying what's within reach? What can we work with? And that's where you got started.
Yeah, you take a look at what do you think it's going to take. And when we said we're going to go invest in businesses in Africa, if I came to any of your podcast friends here and said, hey, let's go invest in Africa, I bet they turn around and run the other way. You're going to invest where? No, wait a minute, my hard-earned dollars? We said, well, why don't we start with donor-advised funds, but not as donations. DAF capital can be invested. It, quite frankly, is invested until it's donated. Why don't we take the DAF capital? It de-risks the capital on behalf of people that are, they've already given it away anyway. Let's go find a better ROI on impact by investing in businesses that create the jobs and don't use up the capital. We earn returns, and the returns then flow back to the donor advised funds. So we started using available capital with people that were willing to do that until I met one wonderful couple. And all of the lights just went off when the wife understood what we were trying to do. And she said, you know, we have financial advisors that are absolutely superb, group from Ron Blue. And I don't begrudge anything in terms of the return they're generating. But David, when I meet Jesus in heaven, is he going to ask me, what did I do with the capital that I gave away or the capital and talents he gave me? Mm-hmm. And I said, I think we all know that it's what we've been given that we're supposed to be stewarding. And she said, I think so too. Can we invest straight up regular investment capital, not donor advised fund? And that conversation happened right before COVID. Mm. And that $400,000 investment from this couple in our earliest days gave us the seed capital to make one of our best investments into a fabulous company in Kenya that we invested in April of 2020. John Mark, you may remember April of 2020, everybody was not talking to anybody in person and behind everything. And the Lord had given us the capital and the wherewithal to really make an investment in a company that today is 20 times larger than that and impacting tens of thousands of lives of families in Kenya.
Wow.
Because she and they were willing to use a different kind of capital, not just donor capital. And that's the innovation that comes with time.
That's fantastic. And so just thinking, 20 times larger. Five times yep. larger is a lot larger, right? 20 times larger is absurd. Right? That's enormous.
Yeah. 300,000 in revenue to 6 million in revenue and 1,000 farmers to more than 30,000 trained. And it's just been a joy because each one of those farmers used to live, many of them, not each, many of them used to live in mud huts.
Right.
And now they're living in cement block homes with tin roofs, connected to the grid, kids in school. Wow. Things that I really dreamed that we could do at scale in the microfinance model that, quite frankly, we didn't do at scale in the microfinance model to the extent that we can. Good jobs with great incomes have that kind of power. And that's why we said talent needs to exist. But that's we want to see unicorns of a different sort,
right?
Not financial unicorns. We want financial returns. That's for sure. But we'd like to see job-creating unicorns because we think that's what brings joy to the Lord.
That's fantastic. Was that Kintegra? Is that who you're talking about?
Yeah. Yeah.
That was, it's been a little while since I've...
Third company. So, yep.
Great job, man. That's just fantastic.
Yep.
So there was a book I read recently. You may be familiar with this gentleman. It's called Best Things First. His name is Bjørn Lomborg. And it is the Copenhagen Consensus. It's his company. Does that ring any bells for you?
It does not ring any bells for me. Sounds like something I should go find, though.
Well, I think you may run in similar circles, or at least have in the past. And his book, Best Things First, argues resource allocation, right? We've got to look at aid differently. We have to look at development differently. We need to allocate resources where it actually makes the biggest difference. Yep. He makes a very strong case for improvements in trade as being one of the greatest levers for job creation, one of the greatest levers for, wealth building in the global South.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious to pick your brain on a couple things. When
you
scaled up, you were working in a massive scale up with everything doing microloans. And you said it just didn't go far enough versus what you've done with talent. And you're like, it can absolutely go far enough. Let's do the apples to oranges comparison here. What did not work enough? I'm not saying anything negative about microloans. It's great. But what did not, what was the unscalable feature there? What was the limit that you were facing?
The microfinance model does phenomenal work to help individual family members have more stability, sometimes kids in school, frequently kids in school, and get people away from loan sharks. So it does a lot. And in the finance world, there's some amazing stuff happening in EduFinance and other ways to get even more kids in school well. So it does a lot of that. But if you said, are those typical microfinance clients wired as business entrepreneurs with the creativity to take an idea, run with it, and scale the business to go from an idea to 300,000 in revenue to 8 million in revenue? The answer is no. And the data says that rarely, 3 to 5% more microfinance clients could actually scale a business to be more than family members at anything. So think a 5 or 10 person company would be unusual for most microfinance. Yet if you look at what all the data, sorry, I started at Bain, data-driven, you said, what did I learn? I learned data matters. Go find the data. Small, medium enterprises, in particular mid-sized companies, create 70% of all of the jobs in the U.S. and in developing nations. So if you really want to create jobs, then you have to get somebody that can actually be running a medium-sized business and grow it and scale it to create the jobs that will lift people out of poverty.
Right.
Most people don't understand that the reason that China is no longer ground zero for people living in extreme poverty is the loosening of the free enterprise system unlocked the power of China and the businesses there to create jobs and lift people out of poverty. China has succeeded in eradicating extreme poverty. That's less than $2 a day. When you look at the data, Africa has failed at eradicating extreme poverty. So it's, again, look at the data, needs jobs. Jobs need entrepreneurs. Microfinance didn't get capital in the hands of people that were capable of growing and scaling, mm-hmm. or into the hands of people that had already started a medium-sized company but lacked the capital to scale it. Right. Talentin finds those people, brings capital to people that already have $1 million to $5 million in revenue. They're small to medium-sized companies, but they could be $50 million companies if they had capital and expertise to help them do that. That's the scaling piece that we felt was needed to tackle extreme poverty at scale.
That's so well said. Obviously, this is what you do for a living, but it's so well said. Yeah. When you look at the GDP per capita of what happened from 1980 to like 2010 in China, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's truly hard to fathom. Other things were taking place at the same time that someone could say, yeah, well, this also happened. It was terrible. Yeah. Yes, that's true. So we're just looking at one data point here.
I wish I could show the graph that's in my head for your audience. But if you can envision a chart over the 40 or 50 years between 1970 and 2020, 1970, you go back and the percentage of people living in extreme poverty in the rest of the world, that's principally China and India and Africa, both parts of the world have about 45% of the world living under $2 a day. That recently, 1970. Then you do two lines, rest of the world and Africa. Rest of the world right now today, that number is down around 6%, 7% of the rest of the world still living in extreme poverty. Africa is still living, 35% of Africa still living in extreme poverty. And the number of people in extreme poverty is larger because the population of Africa has more than doubled in that time period. So the chart just screams failed policies in the continent to tackle extreme poverty. Go do something about it.
Right. And I know you believe this. So I'm just going to say it for everyone's benefit. This is not just blaming African nations for African policies. There's been lots of other countries that have benefited from, you know, from those policies that have enforced that.
Well, and it's trade, it's capital, it's quite frankly, foreign assistance. That the more foreign assistance, the worse the GDP growth. It's inversely correlated. So just go look at the data and you say, it's not working. Let's stop doing what's not working and do what does work.
Right.
So,
right. It's fascinating. So did you ever, I think Vern Harnish, he might be an MIT guy, but did you ever run with Vern Harnish?
I know the name, but No, never ran directly with him.
From my perspective, which is a very, very limited perspective, he popularized the idea of scale-ups versus startups.
Yep.
So when I first became aware of you, the great work that you guys are doing, I was like, oh, this is a guy that's focused completely on scale-ups. And how do we help these? You know, Vern responds to them as gazelles. You know, instead of these, we're trying to get away from, you know, a little bit of company to a gazelle to a unicorn, right? So I think that's the evolution that he was talking about there.
Yep.
That's what you focus on. You're focusing on these small, more mid-sized, but mid-sized companies across mostly East Africa, from what I understand.
Where's it predominant? Only right now, East Africa, Kenya, Rwanda, Uganda, and Burundi right now are the four countries where the jobs are created.
It's fantastic. And, you know, those are markets that are poised, that are very much emerging and poised to do very, very well. So, like, you're doing a lot of great things there. Now, there's hiccups, I'm sure, along the way that we can talk about.
Yep.
I'm just really thinking it's the capital, but it's the expertise, right? It's the consultative training and growth and resourcing that's so helpful for these companies to grow. Because you also have a network of advisors that are very much been there, done that. Now, let's help others achieve similar outcomes.
Yep.
That's great.
And that's what it takes. And some of my colleagues want to say that we focus on elephants, not gazelles. That they're companies that may not look like a Silicon Valley, but they can be big, strong, and growing, and let them do their thing, and jobs will be created. So just some African language takes the gazelle to the kind of companies that we like to support. So.
But you're also looking at, you know, cash flow positive scale-ups rather than just venture-backed, you know, growth for growth's sakes. You're looking at good old-fashioned businesses that are here to stay.
Yeah. I mean, agribusinesses, manufacturing businesses. One of our fun businesses we like to refer to as the IKEA of Africa. It's got to be called Moco Home and Living and mattresses and furniture, but they are growing like a weed. They've probably tripled since we first invested in them 4 years ago, and $10 million in revenue now. Super, super fun people to see what they're doing to bring real high quality products and great jobs to hundreds of people, and hopefully soon thousands of people with what they're doing in Kenya. So
that's fantastic. That's fantastic. So to go back to the crux of why jobs, or why investing in companies over just microloans, it's just people. I had a conversation with a gentleman who runs a great NGO in Afghanistan, and we were talking about the microloan conversation. He's like, here's the thing. What's the percentage of Americans, so people living in the United States, what's the percentage of them that actually become entrepreneurs? Yeah, it's 7-9%.
A couple of percent. Yeah.
Not very many. He's like, then why are we spending so much money? Why are we raising so much money to go turn everyone and everyone and their mom into an entrepreneur if we know that it's already going to be such a small percentage?
Yep.
Same conversation that you guys have probably, obviously had many times over. And it's just, it's a different kind of 80-20. It's a little bit more like 93-7.
I love what we did because loan sharks and desperation breed nothing but ills. And microfinance did some phenomenal things to get people up to base level of support and get them sort of up above $2 a day. But if you want to see societal transformation, there's a ton of reasons this is oversimplified, but take Bangladesh. Muhammad Yunus won the Nobel Prize for what he did with the Grameen Bank. Mm-hmm. Millions and millions and millions of micro entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. But look at Bangladesh today versus Bangladesh 30, 40, 50 years ago. And what's the poverty level for the majority of people? It's not as much different as China. What was different? China didn't have the micro enterprise engine that might have been there, but it did have the business development engine with bigger businesses. Mm-hmm. That's what it took to lift the society. And with real jobs comes hope and dignity and prosperity. So those are two country macro level. And, the people that do all the PhDs on this stuff will say why there's a thousand different reasons. But there's two case studies that you just look at them and ask yourself, which one do I want to bet on for Africa in order to see Africa follow the economic, not the political, trajectory of China? Or we ought to be cautious about China's influence in Africa. Otherwise, it could follow the political trajectory of China, too.
Right. No, that's a great point. You look at Lee Kuan Yew with Singapore. Very similar strategy, very similar situation. I think you and I could have fun talking about economics and trade a little bit longer than most people would like to listen.
Yeah. Most people don't care. So if you care about poverty, if you care about serving the least of these, go right to Matthew 25. We're just giving you a way to do it.
Which is great. It's really, really great. But it's important because obviously we have clients that do microfinance, and it's a great thing, right? Because what you just said, so many people are taken advantage of. It's a terrible situation. I mean, living on less than $2 a day is a horrific life. I don't think enough people understand how challenging that is. So it's a huge need, but it really is, how do you break through that next ceiling? What are the levers? And it requires, government infrastructure. It requires, it's not just, I had a startup idea and I launched it and off we go. There's a lot of context that's required. And so working in the countries that you do work has sufficient enough infrastructure, obviously, with what you've done and what your team's continuing to do there.
Yeah, the infrastructure exists in places and it doesn't in places. One of our newer client companies is in Uganda. Some of your audience may remember the Lord's Resistance Army that ran around and did terrible things in that part of the world decades ago now. The data would say that people, the farmers in that community, on an economic level, earn 11 cents per person per day. Just think about that for a moment.
Right.
And all of my nonprofit friends, and there's a lot of nonprofit work, say, we need to go do something. And I said, yeah, we do need to go do something. We're going to go invest in a company that now has planted over 7 million trees on their way to multiplying that These trees grow by 7 feet per year and can make renewable source of charcoal. And the unique have the tree, and it grows again another tree and another tree. And the important thing is that those farmer families can then have thousands of dollars of income per year by growing a renewable crop of charcoal producing and making charcoal. So how do we help move 11 cents a day people to something much better than that? Right. Find a way that creates an economic engine that works at scale. And that's the joy we get by investing, in this case, in Kajani Forestries, the company in Uganda. And it's just going to be neat to see how big can they go. There's a chance that they could also do some of this work right on the borders of some of the refugee camps, which historically, my nonprofit friends say, what can we do to create jobs for refugees stuck near or in a camp? Not lots of great answers historically.
Right.
Maybe there's a way to help in this kind of thing. And by the way, Uganda's being deforested by people that need to feed their families, and they cut down trees to create cooking fires to feed their families. And anybody that's been to Haiti knows the end of that story is not a good one.
Yep. I spent a large percentage of my life on that island nation, and I can tell you that it's, deforestation is real. It is not an insignificant thing. It's not an insignificant
thing. Go to the Dominican Republic, and it didn't have to happen. Yep.
Just go to Google Earth. You can see it very, very clearly. It's very, very clear. So here's something interesting. I'm going to push back a little bit. I'm going to be the
That's fine.
I'm a recent college grad, anti-capitalist. So tell me why, why is it okay to leverage capitalism? Is capitalism not causing too many problems? Because this is a private equity, debt-based, focused fund, which John Mark believes is very effective, but let's just play devil's advocate over here. Why are you so keen on or okay with leveraging capitalism in places where capitalism has not been quote unquote successful?
Yeah. So I'd say, go show me any place where economic development has worked at scale with pure government funding and or only nonprofit dollars. And I don't think you'll find it. Now, that doesn't mean that it's unbridled capitalism. We actually created talent in it's what's called a public benefit corporation. So my nonprofit friends will understand that we get to prioritize social impact over financial returns legally. That's important. But the joy of good capitalism, the public benefit kind of capitalism, is that it creates an economic engine that grows and self-finances. Mm-hmm. So for any of your non-capitalist friends that want to create solutions to the world's biggest problems, if you're not looking for something that grows and brings capital, it's not going to solve the big problem. So you have to get to those two things, sustainability and scalability, and then we add our transformation. Our three things: we want to see lives change, transformation. We want it to be scalable. It will keep growing. And we want it to finance itself. And when you put, it's like gas into an engine, it goes, well, capital into a good, well-run business that's impacting people's lives for the better. That's the sustainability. It takes profitability. And for young college graduates that haven't understand that capitalism can do fabulously good things, it takes good people focused on others, not just people focused on their own bottom line. That's what it takes to be good capitalism.
Mm-hmm. It's very well said. And I remember the first time I started studying generative models, my mind just lit up. I was like, oh my gosh, this is it. This is how you make it work. You read Jim Collins and read about flywheels. You're like, oh wow, this is how you do it. Okay, perfect.
Yep.
Lights up so many different things. So how do you define? I think definitions are super important.
Yeah.
And impact, sustainability, those are phrases that mean a million different things to different people. So from a Talentin perspective, from David Sims' perspective, what does sustainability really mean?
Well, a couple of different ways. Sustainability for a company. It's my old nonprofit language in the for-profit. Anybody only talks about profitability, not sustainability, but a profitable company, meaning it's not money losing. And by the way, it needs to be cash flow positive, not just profitable. That's the sustainable engine that will allow that organization to continue into the future. So if you don't have a way that it's going to continue into the future, you're going to limit your results. Sustainability at a family level gets to jobs. If I want to know that I can send my kids to school today and tomorrow, the sustainability says, oh, I have a paycheck coming, or I have the ability to grow a crop and get a fair price for my labors. That's the sustainability of a family. That means I can feed my kids, get medical care, have a decent house, and hope for a brighter future. So there's a family level sustainability that I think at the end of the day, and there's some research data on this from Compassion from the earliest days that shows that hope is the engine of sustainability. And I think it's probably hope and grit, but it turns out that hope helps with grit. You get knocked down, you get up when you understand that you have hope that things can be better. And if you don't have hope, you get knocked down and you stay down.
Right.
So the sustainability is more than an economic piece. There's a psychological and I'd argue a spiritual piece to hope that that is the sustainability that leads to a flourishing. And I think it's temporal and eternal that you really hope that people have that kind of sustainability.
That's great. I love that, David. And so when you're looking at these scale-ups, you've got to see, obviously, the business plans, the growth projections. But like you said a few moments ago, you're saying, we're looking at more of the impact side. We want to know, like you filed intentionally to be just as or more focused on social impact than just financial returns. And so you're baking those impact metrics into the process. You're saying, what is this company going to produce from a social impact standpoint that we are also interested in? We're just talking about investor company alignment here.
Yep.
That's fantastic that you started it that way. You intended to build it that way, but that you've seen the results. You've been tracking that impact as well, correct?
Yeah. We're now at 83,834 jobs that we've tracked impact direct or farmers and miners that are suppliers to the companies. But back to your, we care about those impact, but if we can't and have, we have been generating the financial returns, our own talented sustainability means that as we deliver financial returns, that's the economic justification that lets more capital come to let us go get more jobs and impact. So we can't skim or skip over the fact that it needs to be a profitable investment for our investors, debt in one fund, equity, a private equity fund that we're just launching now. We have both, and that's the mother's milk of impact, right? That's still what it takes. So my nonprofit friends understand you can't, you know, no margin, no mission, we used to say in my nonprofit days. It's still true. You have to have an economic engine to deliver on your mission.
Have to. It's really, really easy to spend it all, right? That does not mean there's going to be a future.
That's correct.
Right. Absolutely. Dave, this has been a fascinating conversation. I'm super grateful for your time and for sharing this with so many people. Any other parting words or any other just moments of inspiration you want to share with people as they go down? There's a lot of mission-driven leaders that listen to this and bold, tenacious, but it is sometimes a thankless job. So if there's anything you want to leave them with, I know they'd be grateful for it.
Yeah, I just encourage people that are involved in any kind of missional work that it really matters. I hope it matters to you and your friends. I hope it matters to God. That would be my personal prayer for you. Don't be afraid to go tackle things that haven't been done before. That can be energizing, and it's a whole lot better to tackle them with a group of friends that you can travel together, whether it's your team, your board, bunch of donors or investors. That community gives you the ability to go far and to accomplish your mission. So think bold and do it with others.
That's fantastic. David, I really appreciate this. This has been really, really great. Thank you so much.
Super. Thanks so much to you.